Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. I'm Karen, and today I'm once again joined by...
Kristen! Good day. Good morning,
good
fellows.
Good day.
Good day, sir. Yeah, no, I have no idea where that came from. How's everyone doing?
We are starting off great. This is awesome. If you would like to contact us and laugh at all of our jokes and make fun of us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Today's going to be a cool episode. We're going to talk about the Nico D'Angelo book. We're going to talk about it in depth. We're going to give you guys some theories and all of that, our thoughts on the whole process and what the book could actually be about. I'm really excited for this one. I wrote an entire article about it because I could not contain my excitement. But first, we're going to jump into some news and updates. There's not a whole lot going on right now. We just got a couple of cute little things to talk about. And the first one is that Kwame Mbalia tweeted about why he loves writing Kid Lit. And his tweet says, "Tonight's event at Flyleaf Books reminded me of why I love writing Kid Lit. The kids had wonderful questions. We laughed and told jokes. It was so amazing. Somebody even told me I was their favorite author. Me. Y'all know I tear up at the drop of a dime, so I'm in my feelings." I may have cried when I first read this, too. Aww. I thought it was so cute. And I don't know. I just, like, whenever people say that they appreciate, you know, our writing or what we do on the podcast and stuff, like, you can't help but feel kind of emotional because you put so much of yourself into that kind of stuff that I totally know how he's feeling, and I loved it, and I just, you know, he looks like this big kind of gruff guy who writes these middle grade books and cries a lot because the kids love him, and I really appreciate that.
Right, it's really cute.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was, so there's this podcast called Fathoms Deep Podcast. I don't know how big this podcast is, to be honest. I mean, they have almost 3,000 followers on Twitter, but they are a black sales podcast, and they actually quote tweeted one of Becky's tweets about the Percy Jackson TV show and said, "Another fun commonality between black sales and the Percy Jackson TV show, other than the fact that the guy who made black sales is making Percy Jackson, says modern stories with roots in Greek mythology and also that John Steinberg guy. You can listen to our black sales and mythology episode here," and they link to it, and we'll put that in the show notes. But I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like,
yeah. You
know, I didn't think about them having something to do with Greek mythology, but it makes sense. And I love that there is a little bit of a connection between the two, between these vastly different shows, let's be honest. Percy Jackson is not going to be anything like Black Sails.
No. Disney Plus versus, what, Stars? It's going to be...
Oh, it's going to be way
different.
It's going
to be a little different.
Yeah. I never watched Black Sails, which I had mentioned before, but I've seen some of Outlander, which is also on Stars. Very different.
Yeah,
we are not going to expect that for the Percy Jackson show, and we shouldn't.
Right.
There was no expectation of that.
Very different audience.
Yes.
That it's being made for. Yes. Not that we'll appreciate it, because I think everybody's going to appreciate Percy, but yeah, Black Sails definitely made for an older, skewed audience.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah. But still, I am still interested in watching that.
Oh, yeah.
It's on my to-watch list coming up here.
Yeah. Kristen told me the other day that it was really cheap on Vudu, so I went and bought it. It was like 4 seasons for $15.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and bought it. So I officially own it now.
Nice.
Even though I do think it's free streaming somewhere, but I was like, this is just easier.
I couldn't find it when I went looking for it. Stars is really particular. Like, Outlander is on Netflix now, but, like, it hadn't been until about
it might be,
6 months ago.
I know Hulu and Stars have a thing together, too, so it might be behind a paywall on Hulu.
I was going to say, but I think you have to have a Stars subscription, or you have to, like, pay a certain amount a month to have access to the Starz shows. Yeah, it's a whole thing. Showtime does the same thing with Hulu.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it's not... I mean, I've heard good things about the show. We have friends that love it.
Oh, yeah.
So, I think it'll be worth
We'll watch it at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do an episode on that when we run out of ideas down the line. But until then...
A while from now.
Yeah. We have a spreadsheet. There is a spreadsheet.
All the spreadsheets.
Yes. We love a good spreadsheet. Okay. So today, like I said, we're going to be talking about the Nico D'Angelo news. And we talked about this a little bit on some previous episodes, but I really want to go in depth on a lot of different elements here. Like I said, I wrote an entire article on subjectifymedia.com about this. And if you like, you know, reading things... then you could go read it there. That sounded a lot better in my head, like a lot more intelligent.
If you want Karen's extended thoughts about Nico and all things Nico's new book, they're there. Yeah.
Thanks, Kristen. Always making me look better.
It's okay. It's all right. Daytime is rough.
It is rough. We can't do mornings. We can't do afternoons. It's We're going to have to try an evening show and see if that works. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. And as we mentioned previously, Rick's going to be co-writing this book with Mark Ashiro. Mark Ashiro is an established author in their own right, and they've written a couple of different things. Their novel-length stories include Anger is a Gift, Each of Us a Desert, and Insiders. Plus, they've also written short stories, nonfiction, that sort of thing. I'll put a link in the show notes to their website and a list of all of their books, because there was a lot. Like, I couldn't actually list all of them because of all the little projects that they had done. But, you know, they've written middle grade before, and I think YA as well and stuff. So, like, they've got a hand in a few different things. I had actually heard of Mark Ashiro before. I don't know if you had.
The name sounded familiar, but, like, I don't have a large, I don't think I've read anything by them, and I don't think that I necessarily have heard people, like, talk about their books, but the name sounded familiar when Rick said it. So, like, just general book, being in the book world and book Twitter and all that, like, I think I've probably heard of them, but just not.
I had heard of them years and years ago. As soon as Rick said Mark Ashiro, I was like, wait a minute, is that? And I went and looked, and their handle is Mark Does Stuff on Twitter. So if you ever heard of Mark Does Stuff, like, they read through the Harry Potter books for the first time and kind of, like, live tweeted it or did a YouTube series on it or something. I don't know. This was years ago, and I had friends who had followed them and were telling me about it. And so as soon as the name came out of Rick's mouth, I was like, you're kidding. So I thought that was kind of like a weird connection to, like, years ago when I had heard of them. But it's really neat that, and I'm pretty sure when Anger is a Gift came out, like, I definitely heard about that one because that was everywhere. And I think that's one of their biggest books.
I definitely recognize the cover of Anger is a Gift.
Yeah.
More than probably even their name. Like, I just was like, oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I remember that.
The other really awesome thing about Mark is that they are a huge Percy Jackson fan and love Nico. And at the end of the day, like, that's really all I want. I don't really need anything else. Like, as long as they appreciate what Rick's done and appreciate the character and stuff, you know, I think that's, like,
I mean, the biggest. I trust Rick, and I trust him to choose a co-writer that's, you know, got the best in mind for Nico, which I absolutely believe that Mark does. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, if he had chosen someone who maybe didn't know Percy very well, like, maybe Rick chose them because they don't know, they aren't completely engrossed in the world and he wanted a new perspective or something like that, I think I'd be more worried. The best thing he could have done was pick somebody who knows the Percy Jackson world, who loves it, who knows Nico, who identifies with Nico. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all you need. Yeah. Like, just right there, you know Mark is going to do their very best
yeah.
by Nico.
Because at the end of the day, like, that's more important is connecting with the type of character that Nico is. All the other stuff is just research. All the other stuff is just reading the books and trying to get, like, Rick's voice. And, of course, Rick is going to be there every step of the way. We'll talk about that in a second. But as long as Mark appreciates what Rick is trying to say with Nico's character and can emulate that as a person part of, you know, the queer community too, then I think that's the most important part.
Agreed.
I want to read Mark's tweets from that night that they announced this. They said, "Hi, I can't believe it's real, but I'm 30,000 words into this book already, so it's real," which is already like, ah, he's like halfway done.
That's big words. Those are lots of words.
Lots we of like words. This. Yeah. They said, "I'm writing the next Percy Jackson book based on Nico and Will's journey to Tartarus with Rick Riordan. I first read the Percy Jackson books in 2018 on a recommendation from at Whimsically Yours. Because I needed something to distract me from the stress of my tour for Anger as a Gift. I devoured the books up through The Burning Maze, then reread them all again last year." Burning Maze is
Trials of Apollo book 2 or 3?
2 or 3? Something like that.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but it is.
But that would make sense, like, reread them all and then kept reading.
Yeah.
"To say I love Nico and Will is an understatement. To say I'm honored to get to write their story feels trite. This is the greatest privilege I can possibly imagine. And to all of you Solangelo fans out there, I'm one of you too. And I'm going to write the best book ever. Thank you for giving me a chance, Rick Riordan. You've already changed my life in ways I'll never forget." And then basically just said the person that, you know, they're most excited to see the reaction from is Joel Rochester. "Wake up and come back to Twitter," which was funny. But, yeah, this just, like, I mean, again, like you said, we trust Rick. Like, I wasn't worried. I was surprised when he had first announced that he was co-writing a book because he had never done it before. And I honestly didn't even think that was, like, on a table. Like, I didn't think it was an option.
He never has. I mean, he's written how many series, how many Percy books, how, you know, with the Trials of Apollo books, that's kind of a spinoff from Percy. Like, he's never...
Yeah.
Even hinted that he wanted to co-write. So it was a bit of a shock, but it's a good surprise.
Yeah. And I think with Rick Riordan Presents, that was sort of his solution to not being able to write all the books that people had requested of him. So I just always thought, okay, like, you know, he can't write these books, but he's going to give his platform over to people who can. That's the solution. Never did I ever think that maybe down the line he'd be co-writing something. But, yeah, so, I mean, I wasn't worried at all because I really trust him. And I think that he does everything from not only a place of love for his own work, but for real respect for the Percy Jackson fandom. Like, there are very few authors, I think, who have a platform as large as he does, who are so interactive and understanding and personable with their audience. So this just made me very excited.
He's also basically the gold standard when it comes for including diverse characters in your books, but also not speaking for them. Like, he, again, he's writing an eco book. He knows the world wants an eco book, but because he doesn't necessarily have the perspective to write from Nico's point of view, he finds a co-writer who can absolutely write from Nico's point of view, and here we go. Like, now we get a Nico book. So I'm interested to see how this might influence books down the line, where he might reach out to people with the heritage of some of his characters in order to do them right. Like, if we get, I'm trying to think of, you know, like, if we get a Piper book, it would be someone with Native American ancestry that can speak with, not, you know, from a place of personal cultural significance about what it would feel like to have a Greek parent and also a Native American parent or someone in the culture. Like, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
And I think it's he really does do this right. Like, it's amazing to me that every time we get a new book from him, he manages to handle it exactly the way I, you know, it feels, everything feels good. It feels happy. Yeah. It's not, he's not trying to write for someone else. Mm-hmm. He's just trying to make sure everyone feels included and all the kids feel included yeah. in his books. And that's just so awesome.
Yeah. And this is like a slight tangent, but I think that it's important. Like, obviously we're big fans of Rick and we both respect him a lot as a person and an author. And he has done a lot of things right. He's done a couple of things wrong too. And he's always talked about that and been very open about it. There are blog entries on his website about when he got a detail wrong or he misinterpreted something, and he's acknowledged it and I think tried to change it in future editions and stuff like that. So, like, he's not infallible, which I think is really, really important to recognize too, because, like, John Scalzi is somebody that I've been following on Twitter for a really long time. He's a huge author, done a lot of Star Wars stuff and a lot of sci-fi things. I think I've only read one of his books, but I just really love his, like, Twitter personality. And all the time people are like, oh, you know, I really hope that, like, John Scalzi never lets me down. Like, he's the one white guy that's safe and all that kind of stuff. And he always comes back with, look, I've done things wrong and I will continue to do things wrong, but I'm learning and I'm trying. And I really love that attitude. And I think Rick takes that attitude too.
Agreed. He's not, you know, he's human.
Yeah, exactly.
Mistakes are going to be made. But at least if you're coming from a place where you want to do right and you want to get it right, it's a good place to start.
Yeah. So, circling back around.
Sorry, tangent.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm really excited that he brought Mark on for this project, not only because of Mark's enthusiasm, like in that tweet thread, it made me feel better. I was already feeling fine, getting past the initial shock of, oh, he's co-writing. Like, I didn't know that was an option. Once I got past that, I was like, oh, this is actually really awesome, because Mark is a queer, non-binary Latinx person, and so they're going to bring a lot to the table when it comes to getting inside Nico's head and telling the kind of stories that Nico, you know, if he were a real person, would experience, and the kind of stories that people in that community and people who feel like Nico and relate to Nico will understand and want to see on the page. So we're very, very excited.
Have you noticed? Yeah. Have you said that enough yet?
Seriously. I also wanted to mention that Mark has a Patreon, which I didn't realize, and I'm half considering signing up for because I'm very curious about what's going to be on there. They've said that they'll have behind-the-scenes info about their process and publishing. There will be no spoilers, so, like, you're not going to miss anything by not signing up for the Patreon. Any spoilers, those were air quotes, did you hear them, that they'll post online will be, I think, for everybody. So, like, teasers and stuff. Also, their Instagram will have behind-the-scenes photos and stuff, too. Oh, are we following them? We should follow them.
I don't know if we follow
on
them.
On Instagram.
Probably not, because I'm in charge of the Instagram, and I'm being an Instagram noob. Like, I know nothing.
Yeah, this is a shameless plug for our own Instagram, because Kristen recently started updating it with our episode things, which I really liked and thought that was cool. And we'll try to put some stuff on there, too, like maybe when I get arcs and, you know, books or little, like, I'll show off my Percy shelf or something like that.
I was going to say, I'm also trying to collect some fun little, like, art pieces by some of our favorite fan artists. So if you have any, like, artists that I should check out, feel free to send that to me as well.
Yeah. Okay, so my last favorite thing about Mark was...
Of the many we've talked about.
Yeah. They tweeted me to the Percy Jackson fandom with a gif that says, I'm going to give the gays everything they want. And I absolutely fell in love with Mark in this instant. I think that this is amazing. I mean, if you're writing a Solangelo story, you have to give the gays everything they want, because there is no other option. This is what we need. So in case you're worried about it not being gay enough, it definitely is. And I think from what we've seen of Will and Nico so far, they have a really cool relationship, really interesting. And Nico's this sort of dark, brooding, isn't always comfortable in his own skin kind of person. And Will is just a bright spot in the universe, just a ball of sunshine.
Literally.
Yes, literally.
Will solace, like,
yeah. Yep. So, you know, just that premise in and of itself is so good, like the two of them together, let alone everything else they're probably going to end up doing throughout the book. So,
yeah.
I'm super, super excited. Okay, so we talked a little bit about this in one of our previous episodes, too, but basically how the process is going to work is that Rick wrote the outline for this book, Mark made notes on the outline, and Mark is writing the first draft. Rick will then go through it and kind of make his second draft, and they'll basically pass it back and forth until it's done. So while Mark is writing the first draft of the story, Rick came up with the plot. You know, he did the main outline. It was probably pretty detailed. If you know anything about how, like, either ghostwriting or co-writing works, usually the author who has the idea, who has the big name, like Rick, well, James Patterson does this a lot. He writes super, super detailed outlines, and then somebody will come in and write the story based off of those notes, and then James Patterson will go through and, like, add details and voice and change things he doesn't like, so that sort of thing. So this is really just, like, a cooperative experience between both Rick and Mark.
Which, I mean, honestly, that's about the best you could ask for when it comes to... Because, like, there's a lot of, like, writing duos in the romance world, and a lot of them will each... Like, romance books, obviously, there's two main characters, and a lot of the times they'll split the characters up, and one writes from one point of view, and the other writes from the other point of view, and so then the chapters basically, like, alternate, and so you get two distinct perspectives in one book, which... works mm-hmm. because it's romance and that's basically how it all works. Here it's Nico's book and you've got basically one character telling the whole story. Like, I'm sure we'll get a lot of Will, but like, it's Nico's story, so you can't really do that, like, unless they wanted it to be a Nico and Will story. Like, you need one solid voice. So I love the way that they're going about this, like, making sure that they both have some of them in the story, but also have each contributing, like, their strengths to the story.
Plus, I think tossing it back and forth between perspectives like that would be a lot more time-consuming, which kind of, like, that's the point of the co-writer, you know, part of it anyway, is, like, Rick doesn't have a whole lot of time right now, so he needs somebody to help him. And I think that it wouldn't make sense for them to toss the draft back and forth like that. Not only because of everything Rick's got going on, but Mark also said that they had to put down this book, like, partway through because they had edits on one of their other books that had to be turned in. So it's just deadlines everywhere.
Right.
Just deadlines flying.
All over the place.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think this way makes the most sense and gets me really excited because, you know, Rick's voice is going to be in the entire book.
Yeah.
There currently is no release date, although it's probably going to be 2023. I think they actually said that somewhere, that it probably won't come out till 2023. But as with everything, it depends on COVID and what's going on in the world. So,
I mean,
we'll just see.
An author that I follow, her book was supposed to come out next week, and it's already been pushed 2 weeks, and it's, you know, like, because of COVID and all kinds of supply chain problems and whatnot, it's creating chaos. So hopefully 2023, I imagine the book will be done well before 2023, and it'll just be a matter of
especially if Mark's halfway done now, right? You know, so
for sure. But
I like that they're giving it plenty of time before it comes out to make sure that it's absolutely perfect. Agreed. And there's currently no title, so we'll have to wait till we get a title. I wonder how these are going to be structured. You know, like, a lot of times it's Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, or
I wonder if maybe this will be... I've read authors before that have, like, a series of standalones where, like, they're literal standalones, but all the titles kind of fit together just so that they don't feel like they're just hanging out there all by themselves. So I wonder if maybe there will be, like, a... something like that.
Yeah.
Especially if this goes well and Rick, you know, wants to do more, which we kind of know that's maybe in the works. Like, this is a... a test. This is the first one. This is seeing how the whole process goes. But I have a feeling there are other characters that he wants to do this for, too. So maybe that'll kind of...
It could have, like, a shared... Well, it probably will have a shared series name. I'm thinking, like, I don't know. The Camp Half-Blood... Something clever. Like, I'm not always great at titles.
I was like, the best of the rest... The extended Camp Half-Blood stories or something like that.
Extended universe.
Right? Like, something like that.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about what we think the book is about. We definitely know that it's about Will and Nico's trip to Tartarus. And because of what we read in The Tower of Nero, we kind of know what's to come. So if you... haven't read The Tower of Nero, this is going to be spoilers, but it's been a year, so I hope you've read it by now. On page 375, we kind of get an idea of what's to come. And first and foremost, we find out that Nico has been hearing a voice calling out from Tartarus asking for help. This is not always good news.
No.
It's not always a good sign hearing voices, one, first and foremost. Two, voices coming from Tartarus. Probably not great.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds like a bad thing, hearing a voice calling out from Tartarus, Nico thinks that it's Bob, aka the Titan Iapetus, which we, you know, Bob, small Bob, say hello to the sun and stars for me. House of Hades, I burst into tears. That book is still my favorite book of all time that Rick's ever written because basically of Bob and small Bob and just that whole, like, Tartarus part.
Yeah.
Yeah, so to say I am looking forward to this Nico D'Angelo book is underselling it a little bit. But basically, just to get you guys up to speed, in the Sword of Hades short story, Ethan Nakamura released Bob from Tartarus, you know, Iapetus at that point, from Tartarus. Percy dragged him to the Lethe River and wiped his memory and then told him his name was Bob. And Bob was given a job in the underworld where Nico became friends with him. And I think he, like, confided in him a lot and stuff because he was feeling very lonely and everything. And this essentially led to Bob being allowed to save Percy in House of Hades. He gave up his life to make sure they got out okay. And it kind of made Percy realize that not only had he neglected Bob in all of that time, but he's also been neglecting Nico. And it made him want to be a better friend to Nico. And I think it, you know, after this point, really repaired their relationship a lot. He worked on it a little bit more. And in House of Hades, Bob regained his memory before the end. So he knew that he was Iapetus and knew what Percy had done to him, but he wanted to be a better person, a better Titan than he was beforehand. So he kind of, you know, I think that's a really cool story to have, you know, a redeeming character like this.
Oh, yeah. I've read books before, read books, seen movies, I don't even know, where a character loses their memory and it's like maybe a villain or something. And in losing their memory, they have a chance to kind of start fresh. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they do get their memories back, like, they see that maybe villainy isn't all there is, you know, all that it's cracked up to be. So I kind of love the idea that Bob, who we've come to know and love, is not necessarily, he's going to be able to remember some of what he was before, but also won't entirely lose the Bob we love.
Yeah. Which, I think that really lends itself to the theory that, like, nobody's born evil, that, you know, you kind of turn into a bad person or do bad things because of your experiences. And once those experiences are wiped from your mind, you kind of start off as a blank slate. And most people don't want to hurt other people, you know? Like, you become that way because of what's happened to you, because you've turned bitter and everything like that. And I love that the Titans aren't any different. You know, yeah. I love that Bob decided, like, yeah, I did those things, but I don't think it was right. And now that I know better, now that I've met Percy and I realize people can be nice to me, I want to change my ways. And it's just such a sweet story.
Yeah.
In Tower of Nero, Nico says, I feel like I should look for him, see if I can figure out what happened. He might need my help. I don't like it when people are overlooked, which, again, is so sweet and is part of the issue that he had with Percy, you know, with Percy, him feeling like Percy was ignoring him and that they weren't really as close as they might have should been. So, yeah. Sweet little Nico, sticking up for the little guy. Or, in this case, the very large guy.
Nico's kind of the little guy.
Yeah, in this situation. He is. So, one of the problems that Nico's going to run into is we also find out in Tower of Nero that Hades has forbidden anyone to go visit Tartarus after Percy and Annabeth had their little traipse through the underworld. Can't really blame him for not wanting anybody else to go down there. It's kind of dangerous.
Once Annabeth and Percy do it, everyone else has to try it too. Yeah. Like, I can totally see that being a thing. Like,
yeah.
No other demigods are allowed in Tartarus. I'm just, no.
Yeah. But Nico has a secret weapon, or several secret weapons, in the form of the troglodytes, those, like, little creatures that help him, like, dig and stuff. So they could probably get him down to Tartarus safely, ?
Without having to use a gate that Hades is regulating, exactly. Maybe, so he can sneak in.
You can tell that, like, Will is very weary of this plan already.
Breaking,
like,
rules?
Yeah. Mm. He's like, I don't know if this is a good idea. And Apollo is just like, well, I mean, I don't say I support this, but at the same time, like, Apollo went through such a journey of his own in Trials of Apollo that he likes the idea of Nico trying to help somebody, and especially his kid, Will being his kid. Mm-hmm. He wants him to help people and stuff too. So I do think it's nice. At the end of this chapter, Rachel Elizabeth Dare kind of passes out and gives Nico and Will a prophecy, because she's still the Oracle, but Apollo doesn't hear it. How convenient.
Gosh darn it, Apollo. Yeah. Come on.
And he's like, I don't think I'm going to ask them about it either, because it's a very private thing. And I was like, you're a god. Like, you could ask. I'm sure it'd be fine. But clearly that was because they hadn't come up with the prophecy yet.
Gosh darn it, Rick.
Yeah. And he wasn't sure, probably for sure, if he was going to write the standalones and stuff. It was something he was batting around.
So this was a kindness. He was trying not to get our hopes up, just in case something went wrong and didn't work the way he wanted.
But as soon as I read this in Trials of Apollo, I knew Nico was going to be the first book. Like, it was very obviously a setup to a standalone. And I think it's just smart to do a Nico book first anyway, because that's so many people's favorite character.
Well, and I will say, I think he is the one character from even the main Percy series that you absolutely want to know more of. But because he is so mysterious, and he is Hades' kid, and he does kind of go and come and go as he pleases.
And he's out of time. Like, he was born beforehand.
Right. Like, we have the least, like, what's the word? We have the least, the least right to expect him to just show up when we want him to.
Yeah.
Like, because of the Percy books, and we get used to having the demigods kind of stuck in Camp Half-Blood. Well, because of Nico being Nico and having the
shadow travel.
Right, he's so much more free to do what he needs to do and, you know, be where he wants to be, that he's always been the more mysterious one, and it makes so much sense to make his book first.
Yeah.
It just
and
does.
He's sort of a closed-off character because he's been through so much in his short but long life, and I think that you're right. He's just ripe for a story to be told about him.
For sure.
And Will, when Apollo's like, yeah, I'm not going to ask about it, Will sort of looks up at him and goes, well, it didn't sound good. And I'm like, do prophecies ever sound like rainbows and unicorns?
Right. If they ever did, then you'd be worried.
Yeah.
Like,
this definitely has a double meaning.
Like, prophecies always sound way worse than they end up being. And I don't mean just in Percy Jackson. I'm talking any prophecy in any show ever. Yeah. Because Vampire Diaries did it. The Originals did it. Like, Legacies did it. Every time somebody makes a prophecy, it sounds like someone's dying and it's going to be the end of the world, and it never ends up that way. So, I think we'll be okay, Will. But I 100% would expect Will to say it doesn't sound good. Like, Nico might be like, eh, it's fine.
Yeah.
Like, we'll get through it.
Let's just do it.
Like, Percy's was worst. Or, you know, whatever. like, oh, I've heard worse. It's not that bad. I expect Will to be like, it's not good. It's not good.
Yeah. Especially, you know, somebody whose father is the sun god going into the underworld, not going to be great for Will. He's going to have some trouble.
He's not in his element.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
will be Nico in Nico's element.
Yeah. So I think that'll be really interesting to, like, play off of that. You know, I'm sure Nico's going to be the stronger one. I'm sure he's going to be the one kind of leading the charge. And Will might have to deal with his own insecurities, and their relationship could have a couple bumps in the road and everything. So yeah. We'll see what happens. Okay, so switching gears again, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but I really want to talk about why Rick having a co-writer is a good thing. Like we talked about before, it allows the story to be an own voices story and will bring more authenticity to it, to Nico's tale, because Mark is part of the queer community. And I think the thing that I'm most excited about is that logistically this is better for Rick anyway, because he's working on a Percy Jackson show, a Kane Chronicles movie, Daughter of the Deep movie, his Irish mythology story secret project, and his Rick Riordan Presents duties. Okay, that is a lot.
That's on top of being
so much
a husband.
Yeah.
And a father.
Yeah.
And all the personal things that you go through as well. Like, that's just his professional life, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, yeah, the man is busy.
Yeah, he's definitely busy. So I think him having a co-writer means that he can still work on all these other things. We really want him to keep working on the scripts for the Percy Jackson television show, first and foremost. We know he's writing the Daughter of the Deep movie. It's huge to have him be the person writing the script for all these adaptations, because we know it will make for a better adaptation of his source material. I don't want any of that to change.
For sure.
I also don't want to give up a Nico D'Angelo book.
Or have it majorly delayed.
Yeah.
Because the other option is Rick continues to do all the things he's doing, but because he can't write 5 books at once, the Nico book gets shoved to the back of the mm-hmm. list, and when things calm down, he takes the time to write it.
When things calm down.
Which is never.
Because think about it. Yeah. They want, ideally, a 5-season Percy Jackson show.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, the Kane Chronicles movies are going to be a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
So you're already talking about 5, 6, 7 years in the future. I don't want to wait that long for Nico and Will.
Well, and can you honestly imagine that this Percy show goes off well, they have no interest in Heroes of Olympus?
Yeah. Like, or Magnus.
If it gets off the ground and, you know, really does well, which I 100% expect it to.
Yeah.
I just don't see any way in which they're not going to be interested in, even if they have to change the cast, because 5 years from now, the cast might have aged out of their roles.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they have to recast Percy and Annabeth and all of them to do Heroes of Olympus, like, it's still a fantastic story all its own, even if they have to kind of start over and, you know. So, like, there really isn't a future where Rick has all this free time.
Where Rick has time.
Like, no. There just isn't. There's going to be more and more projects, especially as he continues to create new series, when he's working on, you know, the Irish mythology and figuring out what that's going to be, whether it's a standalone or, you know, a new series, a 3-book series, a 5-book, who knows, you know.
Yeah.
So he just, I'm really, really glad that this is kind of the solution to the problem, is to get some help and mm-hmm. get some really, really good help.
Yeah, I was going to say a handpicked person who is actually perfect for the job, I think just means a lot, not only to Rick, not only to the author co-writing the book with him, but also to the fandom in general. So it feels like a very, I don't want to say calculated because that seems cold, but like, they did it on purpose. Rick knew what he was doing. This was something that he feels like is the best solution to the problem at hand, and I'm on board with it.
Agreed. Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, calculating sounds like he's plotting.
Yeah.
But it's more or less just, like, planning. It's, thinking through, you know, what's best for the audience, what's best for his readers, mm-hmm. and wanting to do what's right by Nico at the same time.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's a little scary for him to give up some of that control and put this character in somebody else's hands. You know, like, anybody who's written anything, as soon as an editor comes in and wants you to change a single word, you're like, I don't know if I agree with that. And then you reread the sentence, you're like, okay, I guess you were right.
I write 1,000-word think pieces on popular culture, and I get defensive about my writing. Like, no, that sentence is exactly how I want it to be. I'm not changing anything. It could be changed. Yeah. So, like, I can only imagine
an entire character.
Yeah. In a world that only you've written in, like, it's gotta be hard. So, yeah. Yeah. I trust Rick. Hashtag I trust Rick.
It's, yeah. And just think, like, if this goes well, we could get more books with other co-writers. And, I mean, that's what I'm really excited about. And I guess that's a good segue into, like, the last main thing I wanted to talk about, which is, what are the chances that this could lead to future projects? I think it could lead to a lot of things. Maybe not everything I've written down here. I went a little crazy with some of my ideas about what this could mean. But I like to think big and hope for the best. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
I mean, why not?
Yeah. So I think that, I guess, like, yeah, we could have other books with other co-writers. And I think we were talking about next week, we might do an episode about the standalone novels outside of Nico's story that we would really like them to explore, whether it was, well, I mean, it'd be Rick and somebody else. So we could even try to pick some authors that we think would be a good, you know, deal. Send it off to Rick. Be like, here's our list. Here's a suggestion. Let us know what you think.
If you take any of these, just send us a free copy. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, that's all we want. We don't need royalties or money. Just free copy of the book.
That's all we want.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that it would be fun to pick like a handful of characters that we'd like standalone novels for and kind of pitch them to each other. And, you know, if you guys want to get in on the action, send us some feedback. We'll give you all our information again at the end of the episode, but we can read them off and see which characters that you're most excited for. I won't mention it now. I'm going to tease it for next week, but I was surprised by probably the character that came in second when I did a poll of this on Twitter like last year, I think. I think it was earlier this year when I wrote an article on Hypeable. I asked people, you know, what do you want to see from these standalones? And most people said Nico. Second place, surprising character. So
I don't think I remember. Like, I kind of vaguely remember the poll.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I remember.
I'm going to make you wait, too.
Oh,
I'll tell you next week. See if you guys can figure it out. Okay, so, yeah. So possibly more books with more co-writers. That's just more diversity in the Percy Jackson universe. I think it's all good things. I think this also expands the universe in a really interesting way. Rick might be able to open it up to other established writers who want to do Percy Jackson's story, you know, somebody like this is where we start getting to this might not happen territory, but like maybe we could get stories about background characters or a new character that exists in the universe. Kristen has a look on her face.
I'm smiling over here because this actually reminds me of what we talked about last episode a little bit with the Lightning Thief chapters.
Yeah.
Percy is on the pier talking to Annabeth, like, just about to go to dinner.
Oh.
And we see the two naiads in the bottom of the lake.
Yeah.
It's a lake. And they're wearing green t-shirts. Yeah. And it made me think that, like, maybe they belong to Camp Half-Blood, but, like, maybe there's a naiad camp at the bottom of the lake, and they, like, do their own things. They do their underwater basket weaving and all that other stuff. Like, someone could take that on and be like, I'm writing a Naiads book, and it's going to be all about their camp and how they all secretly think that their camp is, like, 38 million times better. And, how much fun would that be?
And how one of them has to go on a quest with one of the campers, and they're like, this, you know, land lover or something like that.
Yeah. Like, that would be so much fun. Yeah. So, yeah. Or, like, them talking crap about Poseidon's kids. Like, they think they know the water. Like, oh, my God, this Joker. Like, that would be so much fun. So, yeah.
It would be.
Totally be on board.
Yeah. I kind of had this idea of, like, Lower Decks, but for Camp Half-Blood. Like, if you guys aren't familiar, Lower Decks is a Star Trek show, and it's basically about, like...
Animated, right?
Yes, it's animated, yeah. And it's about, like, you know, might be about the red shirts or the people who work in, like, the engine room that might be background characters on a normal Star Trek show, but in this show, they're the main characters, and how they have to go on dangerous missions and, like, all the kind of comedic parts that go along with keeping this ship going in outer space, which is hilarious and such a good idea. I think they were gonna make a Marvel one, or did they make a Marvel one? Wasn't it about, like, the insurance company or something? And it was...
Yes.
It might have gotten canceled.
Yes, there... Oh, that's
or maybe it wasn't Marvel. Was it just superheroes?
It was called Powerless.
Yes.
And I don't know if it ever got off the ground. I can't remember. It may have only gotten, like... Oh, I think it got one season, so okay. I think it has, like, 12 episodes.
Was that set in the Marvel Universe?
I don't believe so. It's a DC...
Oh.
The characters are based on DC comics.
Oh, okay, okay.
But it starred Vanessa Hudgens, which is the only... I was like, wait a minute, I've seen this show.
Yeah.
And I think... I don't think I watched all 12. Like, I think I've seen, like, one or two episodes because I wanted to check it out. But, yeah... That is basically the same thing. Yeah.
That, because we have so many, like, blockbuster TV shows and movies about main character superheroes, I think it's a really interesting twist to look at the people behind those superheroes, like, you know, a show about the sidekicks or something where they have their own little sidekick, like, meetup or something once a week. Like, those kind of stories are really interesting to me because you get to see a different side of the main characters and you get to see what goes on with some of the more regular people. So I think a Lower Decks but for Camp Half-Blood would be genius.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to read something like that.
So much fun.
Yeah.
And now I really want to go watch Sky High. Your talk of sidekicks made me think of Sky High.
Oh my god, I haven't seen that movie in so long. I think I still own it, but...
It's a good one.
It's ridiculous.
If you've never seen it, it's a good one.
It probably would actually do well with, like, Percy Jackson fans. I think there's
a good... It fits right in. Yeah,
it's a good tone comparison. Okay, so that was, like, a little bit of a crazy idea, but not totally crazy idea. Here's the actual crazy idea.
I don't know if it's crazy so much as just
logistically impossible.
It's a long shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this isn't... We're not talking about Marvel and Percy crossovers, so it's not totally crazy.
Karen's not asking for a parallel universe.
Yet.
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 Yeah.
Okay, so what if Rick and the Rick Riordan Presents authors collaborated on crossover stories? Because, I mean, honestly, you're right, this isn't totally crazy because there's a lot of shared groundwork here. I was thinking about, this isn't an exact matchup because, like, Piper McLean, who I believe is Cherokee Indian.
Yes, I believe so.
And Rebecca Roanhorse has written about Navajo mythology, so not the same thing.
Nope.
But if she, like, if her character Nishoni and Piper McLean possibly, like, teamed up for a book.
Right.
How cool would that be?
Well, and it would also be really interesting to maybe get a bit of the difference, because when people think Native Americans, they think, oh, I know everything about Native Americans. But, like, every tribe and every, you know, every one of them has their own traditions and they do things differently and, you know. So it would be cool to, like, have Piper and Nishoni teaming up and getting an idea of, like, the difference between the way they experience their culture. Like, that would be really cool.
You're right. That would be, like, a really good educational book, too, for kids and adults who might not know about the subtle differences.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. See, this is such a good idea. I was also thinking about, like, what if Arusha meets Percy Jackson? I think I kind of mentioned that at some point because I think that they would be really interesting characters together, especially if Percy Jackson was, like, the big brother in the situation. He's like, yeah, I've been where you've been. And she's like, no, you haven't. And because they're both a little sassy, silly sometimes. And I just love Roshni Chokshi, so I want her to write all of the things. And then, like, Sal and Gabby teaming up with Leo Valdez.
I will say, having just read you saying Sal and Gabby teaming up with Leo, I haven't read Sal and Gabby.
Mm-hmm.
But the impression that I get from the covers, from the descriptions, is that their chaos would meet very well with Leo's chaos. Yes. And, like, it would be insane.
Yeah.
But so much fun.
Yeah.
Like, I love Leo, but the man, he's chaos.
He is,
and,
yeah.
And it would just be so silly and so much fun to watch them work together and team up for something. Like, yeah. Yes. And Leo traveling through time.
I know. Oh, my gosh. See, Leo, like, I love Leo 100% full stop, but he is a little immature of a character. And, I mean,
absolutely.
That's addressed in the books.
Yeah.
Like, that's why Calypso kind of leaves him for a little bit and all that kind of stuff. Like, he has to kind of step up to the plate. And I think Sal and Gabby would maybe not bring out the best side of him, but definitely the fun side of him.
Well, and sometimes you need an opportunity to be mature in order to grow. So maybe
yeah.
being teamed up with some characters that maybe aren't very mature would give him an opportunity to be
yeah.
the one who thinks through consequences or things like that. So maybe it wouldn't be the worst. Maybe Leo would have a lot of room to grow. You never know.
Yeah, so I think that would be so much fun, and you made me feel better about not thinking that this was totally crazy. I mean, like you said, probably not going to happen. Just at least logistically, it's going to be very hard for them to match up and be able
yeah.
to do this, but I would love to see, even if it's a short story or something, because he did the Kane Chronicles and Percy Jackson short stories, and those were a lot of fun, so.
I mean, to be completely honest, when we first heard the word co-writer, my initial, like, two-second gut reaction before he announced Mark was, ooh, I wonder if it's a Rick Riordan Presents author.
Yeah.
Because they're right there. Like, he works
yeah.
with them. He knows them.
He trusts them.
He trusts them. Like, they're sitting right there. And they all have their own mythologies, a lot of which do somewhat line up with
mm-hmm.
some of the side characters or the, you know, the
yeah.
other demigods.
There's some, like, crossovers and similarities.
Right.
And,
yeah. So it's not that far-fetched that maybe they would be interested. Now, whether or not they have the time with their own series and everything else
yeah.
is a whole nother thing, especially after learning that a lot of these have been optioned and
yeah.
them maybe possibly getting their own big screen adaptations. Who knows? So I'm with you on that. I think it could be really cool. It's just a matter of, like, logistically, is it possible?
Yeah.
So I'm sure if there is an opportunity, they'll take it, though. I mean, who would turn
yeah,
that down?
Yeah, right? Exactly. So basically, fingers crossed. And, yeah, so, I mean, that was basically it for our thoughts on Nico and his upcoming book. I think that there's a ton of potential here. I have really high hopes for it. I'm only a little bit sad we have to wait till 2023 to get it, but like we keep saying, there's plenty to do in between, so I'm sure the time will fly.
For sure. And if you don't have enough, just start a reread now, and if you
yeah.
read a couple of chapters a day, you'll eventually get through the books in
yeah,
time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of, do you want to kick off our Lightning Thief review for this week?
Surely. Okay, so we are now up to The Lightning Thief chapters 9 and 10. Chapter 9 is entitled, I Am Offered a Quest. And in it, Percy is offered a quest. Shocker!
No.
No.
Really?
Really, yeah. No. No, Percy gets the down low about this Zeus and Poseidon feud that he is already pretty much... He already pretty much knows about it from his dreams.
Yeah. Prophecy count number two.
I know, right? but yes, he learns about the feud. He learns that someone stole Zeus's Master Bolt, and Percy, luckily enough, is the one who gets to go get it.
Yeah.
Gets to go find it and return it, and he has a deadline, and it's only 10 days because who needs more than 10 days to cross the country and get it and return it to Olympus, a place he's never been? And,
yeah.
you know, it's a lot, basically.
This part actually hit me a lot harder than I thought it would, because Percy essentially says that it was a crime for him to be alive because the big three had agreed not to have any children after World War II, and Percy was born, and so therefore he's a crime. And it reminded me of Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime. I don't know if you ever read it.
I haven't.
But it's a very, very good book. And he basically talks about living in, like, apartheid South Africa and him having a white father. And basically, because he was, like, mixed race, he wasn't considered black like the other Africans who lived there. And so he was shunned, and it was literally a crime for him to be alive. And so he had to pretend that he wasn't with his mother when they would walk down the street, and like the nanny would have to walk with him and stuff. And if I remember one time he had said, like, he called out for his mom and she had to run away because if anyone figured out that it was her kid, he could be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so sad. So I got a little emotional when Percy was like, you know, it's just a crime for me to be alive. And I was like, that really sucks. And I know these books are supposed to be fun and middle grade and like silly a lot, but like there are some really hard hitting moments throughout the series. And this is definitely one of them for me.
Well, and it's especially interesting considering we have the hindsight of knowing that Zeus already broke the pact. And while Hades didn't, it still complicates the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, Zeus is pretending he's, you know, the innocent party being high wronged.
Mighty.
And what else is new? It's Zeus. But, yeah, so that's, it's definitely interesting, for sure. Okay, so, yes, Percy now knows that he has to get the Master Bolt, return it to Olympus before the summer solstice, and this means taking on a quest, which means he has to go visit the Oracle.
It was so creepy. I do not remember it being this creepy.
You know, as he was, like, describing the attic, I'm picturing, like, what I pictured the first time. And,
yeah,
like, trying to, you know, place myself back there. And I'm like, I don't remember, you know, the mummy. Like, I know she was creepy, but for some reason I think I pictured something different than, like, a creepy unwrapped mummy thing.
Yeah, with like white eyes and like the,
yeah.
I mean, I remember the mist spilling out of her mouth and stuff, but like, it just, I was like, ooh, this is really gross actually.
I also thought it very interesting how Percy describes the feeling of being there, and like, he instantly, upon walking into the attic and getting a sense that there was a creature there, knows that it's not evil.
Yeah.
Like, He talks about how the feeling of being near Mrs. Dodds or the Minotaur was different than being near the Fates or being near the Oracle. Like, he knows that the Oracle's not entirely, like, great and not his best friend here to give him, you know, cookies and sunshine. But the Oracle's not going to hurt him.
Yeah. It's like a neutral entity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I just thought is interesting because I can't remember in my first, you know, 5 read-throughs. I don't know how many times I've read these books. I can't remember, like, really picking up on Percy's sensitivity to spirits and creatures.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of going to keep an eye out to see if this continues. Like,
yeah,
does he always get this, like, gut feeling before he meets a new creature, or as he's meeting a new creature, like, does it always tell him the truth?
Yeah.
Does he always know good from bad? Because I don't think I noticed that before.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, he goes to the Oracle, he gets his prophecy.
Prophecy count number 3.
Prophecy count. I love our prophecy.
I know.
And basically gets he chooses Grover, he asks Grover to come with him. Annabeth has already volunteered, and the quest is on. I feel like we need to talk about the full text of the prophecy.
Yeah,
very quickly.
I think that's smart.
But just to get it on record so that we have a place to go back and look as well. So, the prophecy that Percy got from the Oracle reads, "You shall go west and face the god that has turned. You shall find what was stolen and see it safely returned. You shall be betrayed by one who calls you a friend, and you shall fail to save what matters most in the end."
Mm-hmm. It's a good prophecy.
Except that they rhymed turned with returned, and that just burns me up inside.
Look, I didn't notice that until you said it, and now I'm mad.
Oh, I read it today, and I was like, I didn't notice it the first time, and now I'm really mad about this. You cannot rhyme turned with returned. But no, it is. It's a really good, vague as heck prophecy.
Yeah.
It's specific enough so that we know what he's about to go do,
mm-hmm.
but vague enough that we don't know what's about to happen to
yeah.
him.
It's funny because it gives him a place to start. You know, you have to go west. And it also gives him some warnings, but nothing helpful whatsoever.
Nope.
So it's going to make it interesting.
I mean, he knows he's going to find what was stolen.
Yeah.
I guess that's helpful.
Yeah. I mean, he'll find it, but everything else after that, who knows?
Giant question mark.
Yeah.
Finding it was not going to be the problem. They basically, after talking to Chiron and figuring out who the most likely culprit is and where it probably is. I mean, like, he's basically got that information to start anyway. Yeah. So,
yeah. Also, this is kind of a side tangent, but I just want to let you know that you were right. I mean, we were kind of both a little right, but in this chapter, we find out that Chiron had his suspicions about Percy's heritage, about the fact that he was son of Poseidon, but the gods also get very cranky about other people stepping into their cabins. So when we talked about Percy kind of being pulled back out of cabin 3, it was maybe a little bit of both, a little bit of Chiron going, yeah, just in case, you probably shouldn't walk in there, but he did kind of wonder if he was a son of Poseidon.
Which begs the question for me,
mm-hmm.
why do the gods have no interest in claiming their children or being involved in their lives, but they care about who touches their cabins? Like, talk about, like, mercurial. Like seriously. Territorial about your cabin, but, oh, I have kids? What? What kids?
Yeah,
what
are you exactly. talking about?
Just drove me a little nuts. I got mad. I was anywhere. Anyway. I also wanted to bring up the fact that the Oracle used, like, a vision, like, the Oracle, like, her little mist formed Smelly Gabe and his three friends playing cards, and they're the ones who spoke the prophecy.
Yeah.
And I was trying for the life of me to figure out why. Like, but, like, he could, I don't know if Rick was trying to save Percy a glimpse of his mother. Because, like, I could see the Oracle using Sally to give Percy this would immediately make him take it seriously. But it would be heartbreaking to see, A, to just see his mother in any form again, since he currently thinks she's trapped in the underworld.
Yeah.
Like, I was trying to figure out, like, is there some sort of significance to that? Or was it just the Oracle needed someone to give Percy this prophecy, and it needed to be someone that didn't matter to Percy?
Yeah.
Like, because I can't think of anyone else who could have delivered it that Percy would have, like, taken it seriously and not, you know, had a visceral reaction like he would have if it was his mom.
I guess, like, if the Oracle is pulling images from Percy's life, one of the biggest images is going to be Gabe and his friends playing poker, you know? So, like, could it have been some kids from school around a cafeteria table? Maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't think that would have been as visceral as, like, the Smelly Gabe part. So, yeah, that's a good question, though. Like, I wonder if there is an actual significance to it, or if she just latched on to, like, one of his most recent memories and decided to, like, alter it to convey the message.
Yeah, which is totally possible. And if you think about it, like, Percy doesn't have a lot of people in his life that have been there long term. Like, he skipped a lot of schools. Besides his mother and, like, Grover, who's been around for a little longer than most, he doesn't really have a ton of friends or family or anything. So maybe it's just because this was the group of people that made the most sense.
Yeah.
You know, it might not have major significance.
It was four people sitting around a table and
there were four lines to the prophecy, so these four it is. Yeah. Like, that could very well be what it was. I just, it stuck out to me and I was like, like, it made me wonder.
Yeah.
Okay. The last little thing that kind of stuck out to me, what are the odds that Percy gets a quest that sends him directly to the place he most wants to go?
Yeah, I mean, fate is a fickle, cruel creature sometimes, and the irony here I don't think is lost on us.
Yeah, like, it's his unspoken but dearest wish, and Grover is already a little bit, you know, suspicious of Percy's intention, because he knows that Percy has just learned that the underworld exists and that that's probably where his mom is, and now he's now he has to go there. So it's like,
Yeah. I think that in all of Greek myth, usually the hero is tested in various forms, not only by the monsters that they have to slay, but in other ways too. And I think that this kind of just like falls in line with the tone of what we've seen in a lot of other mythological stories. It's just like you're tested at every turn, and he's going to have to make the choice that's unfortunately best for everybody, not just best for him. I mean, that is what a hero is. So it actually makes a lot of sense when you really think about it that this is how things end up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also, how funny is it that the entrance to the underworld is in Los Angeles? I feel like Rick has always had a thing against Hollywood. Like, he's talked so many times before, especially when the movies came out, about how, like, Hollywood this, Hollywood that, and, like, you know, they're just full of people that don't necessarily... I don't want to say... I mean, they're probably full of people who aren't trustworthy and who... care more about the bottom dollar than doing something that's going to please fans and things like that. I think his attitude toward that has changed a lot now that he's more involved in the process and everything. But, you know, book one.
Yep.
Los Angeles is, you know, the entrance to the underworld. I laughed. This one really made me laugh.
And I love how Chiron says it, like, I thought you knew.
Yeah, obviously.
It's Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that was, like, because it's Los Angeles, which is, like, City of Angels. Like, if that was supposed to have some sort of significance to, like, the dead or, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if that's what he was getting at or if it's, like, it's predictable. Like, it's obvious.
Yeah. I think that, so the show Lucifer also takes place in Los Angeles because that's where the devil decides to go. And I think that it makes sense because Hollywood, Los Angeles, you got a lot of people, you know, quote unquote, sinning, a lot of people like making deals with the devil for like record deals and all this other kind of stuff. And like Hades is very different from the devil, and the Greeks viewed him very differently than we view the devil, even though he deals in death. But I think it's sort of the same concept where it's like it just makes sense for him to be, you know, also on the other side of the country, completely opposite from Mount Olympus.
Which does make, like, logical sense. Yeah. If you're thinking about Olympus being, like, up and the underworld being down, it would make sense that it would be whatever the opposite of Olympus. So, if Olympus is on the East Coast, the underworld, the entrance to the underworld is definitely going to be on the West Coast.
Yeah.
So, it does make sense.
Also, this is the first time that Percy calls Annabeth Wise Girl, and it made me happy.
I loved their interaction at the end of this chapter. Like, it's classic Percy and Annabeth.
Yeah.
Like, literally classic. Okay, so let's dive really quick into our favorite quotes. Karen, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. This is when Mr. D is all mad at Percy, and he's like, you know, I'm... like, he wants to kill him because he thinks that would be... better than the alternative.
Easiest way,
yeah. And Percy's like, no thanks. And he's like, you know, I was only gonna use like a bit of like spontaneous combustion or something. And Chiron goes, spontaneous combustion is a form of harm, Mr. D. And it made me giggle.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Mine comes from Grover, and it's when they're getting their marching orders for this quest and figuring out where they're going, and Grover says, couldn't the Master Bowl be in some place like Maine? Maine's very nice this time of year.
He really doesn't want to go west.
Right? I mean, I get it. I get it. All right, and last but not least, our favorite moments. Karen, do you want to go first again?
Yeah, mine was sort of the entire setup behind the quest, because it's actually brilliant. They can't tell the other gods that Hades might be behind this whole situation because it could just make things worse. And they can't travel by air. So all of a sudden they have, you know, two major restrictions for this quest. It instantly makes it harder. And Grover and Annabeth both have their own personal reasons for wanting to go along on the quest. It wasn't just like, I choose you and I choose you. Like, Grover really wants to get his license. He has to go on this quest. He has to protect Percy. And Annabeth has been dying for an opportunity to go on her own quest. So it also makes sense. And I just, like, again, it's just brilliant writing. And I think that He could have just been like, yeah, this is my only friend at camp. And yeah, like, she's really smart. I'll take her. But they have their own personal reasons. And it just makes for a better story. And all of their personalities combining is going to make for a really interesting narrative moving forward.
Agreed. Yeah, it doesn't get any better than that, really. My favorite moment is Annabeth at the very end of the chapter taking off her Yankees cap and revealing that she's been sitting there listening to this entire discussion. She's such a creep. I know. Like, she's such a... She's just hanging out, invisible, listening in. I know Chiron knows she's there.
Yeah.
Like, I know he knows. So Chiron doesn't feel like it's necessary.
She's not being slick.
Right. And I just think it's funny that nobody... Maybe they're just used to it.
Yeah.
Like, maybe Annabeth does this so that she's in on conversations that people don't think she needs to be a part of or whatever. Maybe they're just used to it. But, like, nobody really reacts to it except for Percy, who's kind of like, why is she, like, she's been here the whole time? Like, you know, like, you can tell he's just kind of taken aback by the fact that there's been an invisible person standing, you know, just to his left or right
waiting
or something.
For her time.
Yep, biding time till she can take off her hat and be like, yeah, I'm going, fool. Let's do this. So that takes us to the end of chapter 9, and we will roll right into chapter 10 here, entitled, I Ruin a Perfectly Good Bus. In this chapter, it's time to hit the road. They have officially begun questing. Percy, Annabeth, and Grover are driven into Manhattan to a bus station by Argus.
I liked Argus.
Our first introduction to Argus.
Yeah.
I just love the eyeballs, and Percy is, like, distracted by all the eyeballs.
He seems so nice, and he, like, winked at him, and I liked him.
Right? And Argus has seen a lot, so I'm sure he sees Percy and Annabeth bickering and is like...
Has he seen a lot because of all his eyes or because he's been around for so long?
I think both. Exactly. Like, he has a unique perspective.
Yes, he does.
Unique
all
point
the
of
eye
view.
Puns.
All the view. Yeah, all the puns. They hop on the bus and they start their quest, and as... You know, they're sitting in the back of the bus. Before they've even left, the Furies board the bus. They see three old ladies in some pretty specific garb.
Yeah.
Boarding the bus and blocking the way so nobody can really get off.
Yeah.
And the quest is officially on. I wanted to talk about how in this chapter, Percy is given Riptide.
Yes.
And Riptide, as we all know, is a beloved, most beloved magical object. How cool of a name is Riptide?
I know, right?
Like, Anaclismus is one thing, but, like, Riptide, being the English form of that, is, like...
It's just, first of all, great for, you know, Son of Poseidon, first of all.
Yeah, like, it's
but
so
secondly,
perfect.
Like, I would be afraid of that, like, just by name alone.
Yeah, it's the perfect name. So yeah. I wanted to, you know, give Rick his props. Like, that is the perfect name for a sword/pen that, you know, is basically created for the Son of Poseidon. It's totally awesome. I also wanted to talk about how Mrs. Dodds has reanimated really quickly here. Mm-hmm. You know, Percy just dispatched her from the Earth, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
At this point, like, it couldn't have been longer than maybe 2 or 3 weeks, tops.
Yeah, because it's been a week that he's been at camp, and prior to that, the Mrs. Dodds incident, like, she was replaced with a different teacher, and I think that was at least a couple of weeks, because they had, like, exams and stuff coming up.
Yeah, so it couldn't be, I mean, maybe a month or two, but, like, no more than that. And she's already back. And it just made me wonder, since she's a flying monster, if Zeus had a hand in making sure that the most furious, I mean...
Maybe.
The Furies do come from the underworld, like, they do come from Tartarus, but, like, because she has a connection to the air, and we know that Zeus's domain is the air, I'm just curious if he didn't have a hand in it.
I mean, I would not put it past him, let's just say that.
Right? Like, maybe just directed a little more of his energy in his, you know, toward Tartarus for this specific reason.
Yeah.
Who knows? Just made me think, especially because we... talked about the whole airplane thing, and I was like, okay, all right. Just something to keep in mind. And it also made me wonder, magical gifts. As they were leaving for the quest, Luke gives Percy a pair of flying sneakers, basically, yeah, with the little wings.
Yeah.
The Hermes wings that you think of when you think of Hermes. And it made me wonder, like, after this book, do we see a lot of magical gifts and, like, magical items? I was trying to, like...
We definitely get a few, but I don't know how often that comes up.
Yeah, like, it seems to be a pretty regular-ish kind of big thing. Like, Annabeth is gifted her hat of invisibility,
yeah,
from her mother on her 12th birthday, and Luke got those shoes from his dad, and Percy is getting Riptide from Chiron, but actually from Poseidon.
Right.
And, like, it just kind of made me wonder if maybe, even if we don't know about it, it is kind of a tradition that even though your godly parent might be absent and kind of, you know, awful,
yeah,
if they've claimed you at all, maybe it's a part of the tradition to kind of give you something. Yeah. So
like, is Clarissa's spear maybe from Ares or something, right, like that?
Yeah. Or maybe a shield or something. Yeah. That she keeps close to her or something like that. Yeah. I'm again, it's another thing that I'm going to kind of maybe try and keep an eye out for, because yeah, I'm interested to see if other demigods have an item that, yeah, is kind of a gift. Might be a thing that Rick kind of wrote in here without pointedly making sure we noticed it.
Right. I only had one other thing to point out in this chapter, and it was about Smelly Gabe. And okay, so we now know that Sally was with Gabe because he smelled repulsively human. So repulsively human that it covered up the strong scent of Percy's demigodness. And yeah, so this made me laugh because what does this say about basically the most human characteristics? So a glutton, somebody who's angry, somebody who's potentially like verbally abusive, mentally abusive, like all of these terrible, terrible traits makes Gabe even more human than other people. And it was sort of like a, wow, that's actually really awful kind of thing. But I also think it makes sense because Greek heroes are supposed to be heroic. They're supposed to be demigods. They're supposed to be better than, you know, regular people in a way. And they're meant to be like more selfless and that sort of thing. So it makes sense that sort of the opposite of that would be human and repulsively so, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting concept to, like, kind of wrap your brain around. Like, he's so human. And so all the worst parts of humanity seem to be a part of Gabe.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is enough to overshadow Percy's, you know, young demigodness. So much so that, yeah, Sally marries Gabe. Ugh, I'm so sorry, Sally. She is really a dedicated
She loves her son mother. So much.
Yeah. Yeah, that takes some dedication. So, it just makes you love Sally all the more.
Yeah.
Literally doing everything she can to keep Percy alive and safe as long as possible. Okay, so let's move in to our favorite quotes. I'm going to start because I'm going to butcher this and I don't want it to be the last quote we've heard in this episode. It starts with some Latin. Brachias meas vestimini, I yelled. I wasn't sure where the Latin came from. I think it meant eat my pants.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, Latin aside, I had to put the Latin in there because it's the whole point of the quote. Otherwise, I would have skipped it. But I mean, yelling eat my pants at a couple of furies is good times.
Yeah, I like that. Nerd alert, I took Latin for a little while because I have an art history degree. And, yeah, I can't really remember how to pronounce some of this stuff. So, we're just gonna let it slide.
I was gonna say, I thought the CI was a CH, so that's why I went with it.
I think it might be.
So, I took Italian diction.
Oh, for, which like, is singing and stuff?
Yes, yeah. Which is literally all about pronunciation.
Yeah.
I have no idea what any of those words mean, so I don't know if Percy's right or wrong, but yeah. I can kind of guess some of the...
I know mass is my. That's definitely my.
Oh, and, my, like, yeah.
Brachus reminds me of, like, britches.
Yeah.
So I don't, although like it would be switch, so Brockus would be the eat part.
Would it be, though? Because I know, like, romance language is usually the order.
Maybe.
Like, in French, the noun always comes first.
I'm Googling it.
Like,
Percy's Latin. There's a whole page on Percy's Latin.
Oh, jeez. Thank God for the internet and for people who find details fascinating, because wikis save my life all the time.
Yeah. Apparently, it actually translates to, "You're eating my pants." So,
which isn't entirely wrong.
That's really funny. That's great.
That's good times.
Okay.
Good times here in the Prophecy Radio Latin Hour.
Yes.
But Karen, what was your favorite quote?
Mine is when Percy is sort of thinking to himself and he says, in his pocket, talking about Grover, in his pocket was a set of reed pipes his daddy goat had carved for him, even though he only knew two songs, Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 12 and Hilary Duff's So Yesterday, both of which sounded pretty bad on reed pipes. When I tell you I literally cackled when I read this line, Hilary Duff's So Yesterday has a permanent place in the pop culture phenomenon that is, like, the 2000s.
Mm.
And
I started singing it immediately.
This just, like, this isn't gonna hit, like, younger readers the way that it hit us, I think. Like, if people continue to read the series and everything, they're gonna be like, what's that? But, like, we grew up on Lizzie McGuire, Hilary Duff, like, all that kind of stuff. It just, oh, it hit the right button for me.
I love the treasure trove that is hidden pop culture references in pop culture. Like,
yeah.
Reading the Percy Jackson books and getting this one little hint at when these are written and what was, like,
yeah,
popular for middle grade youth at this time. Like,
yeah.
Hilary Duff's So Yesterday is the song that Grover chose to learn for his reed flute. Like,
what I want to know is Hilary Duff aware that she's mentioned in Percy Jackson?
That is a good question.
That's what I want to know.
She does have young kids. I wonder if any of them have read these. That would be so
Mom,
fun.
You're in this book.
Hey, Hilary Duff, question. Do you know that you are immortalized forever?
Just DM us. It's fine.
In Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. Yeah. If you're listening, feel free to let us know.
She's definitely listening. Obviously.
For sure, yeah.
Hilary Duff's number one podcast, Prophecy Radio.
Okay, before we get too far off topic, let's go back to our favorite moments. I'll do mine first, just to keep symmetry, you know.
Anarchy!
No anarchy. Not here. Okay, so mine is basically just Percy's fighting instincts. We see them on the bus. Like, Annabeth has basically already planned the best way to get through this. Like, Percy, just go. It'll be fine. Like, she's looking at the situation and forming a plan the moment it starts. Whereas Percy is just standing there panicking. And that's not when his battle instincts kick in. As soon as Annabeth gives him something to do, and he has a task, he slides into an empty seat at the perfect moment so that they can pass him, so that he can get to the front of the bus. And then when he gets to the front of the bus, like, he doesn't have a next move, but his instincts take over, and he's like, this is what I need to do. And then he sees the water, and, like, you know, like, it just, I love watching Percy kind of start to understand the fact that he is a demigod and he has that battle instinct,
yeah,
ingrained in him. He's born with it. It's, you know, it's a part of him. And seeing that right at the beginning here is good fun for me. Karen, what's your favorite moment?
My favorite moment is Riptide's proper introduction, because we did meet Riptide in,
yes,
the first chapter. But this is when we really see what it can do and how it works. And I really loved it. And look, I know it's bad. I know it is. But I keep picturing the movie. And I keep picturing Logan Lerman saying, this is a pen. And it just, it makes me laugh. I think it's one of the better lines in the movie. And yeah, just like we said before, we really like Riptide. It's a really cool weapon.
Pretty soon, we'll have another version of the, it's a pen,
yeah,
not a sword. Like,
yeah,
we'll get this, I'm sure. But Logan has a special place in all Percy Jackson fans' hearts. He's,
yeah,
not, he was not the problem.
He was not the problem.
So we all love him. It's okay. Like, it's, yeah, it's totally fine. All right, and that pretty much wraps up our discussion of The Lightning Thief for this week. Next time we will be reading chapters 11 and 12. Yes, 11 and 12. So we'll be back for that. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can follow Subjectify Media on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectifymedia.com. Subjectify Media is home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators and other things, Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has recently been revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. And of course, you can contact Prophecy Radio to give us all your best ideas and thoughts and comments on the show. You can reach us directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com if you've got lots of thoughts or need the long form to really get your point across. Also, you can find us on Spotify, Apple, or basically any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review, especially on Apple, because that's 5-star reviews really help a show find its footing and for other people to discover it as well. So we would love that. Make sure, you know, feel free to leave us questions and comments, plus ideas for content you want to see. And we look forward to hearing from you. So definitely reach out. Until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.